Even more holistic. Thanks, David. Okay, now I know how to present my work in a concise way. So I'll be even more holistic than that, and I'll go for perception. But before I go for perception, I'll sign you on a contract, and the contract has three items. Let's agree that first, in natural sciences, unlike in mathematics, there is no set of predefined axioms from which other definitions can be driven and improved. Okay, this is one thing. The other thing is that what can be proven in natural sciences are only consistencies. So assumptions are considered valid as long as the outcomes are consistent with actual observations. If you take gravity, for example, then it's considered valid as long as the movements patterns of bodies, of patterns it entails, are consistent with actual movements of the bodies. There's no way to prove gravity from first principles. And likewise, no a priori definition of perception exists. Okay, this is simple. And no scheme of perception can be proven right based on first principles. What can be done is a construction of a set of statements which, if self-consistent and comprehensive enough, can be considered as a valid theory of perception. Do we agree on this, or do we have yes? Okay. No, I think the distinction is only in the level of reduction that you apply. So in physics, currently in physics, I mean, not the physics of the brain, but physics of electrons, you really got to away with reduction. So you talk really about well-defined items, and it's not yet the case in biology. But so if you talk about a cell in biology, it's not an electron. And this is the difference. It's not in the principles of proving a theory. Principles are the same, I would say. Okay, so if we agree on this, then let me just describe the essence of what people call the problem of perception, for at least from the times of Descartes, but probably even before. And the problem emerged from the following contradiction. From everyday experience, we feel that perception occurs in real time with no delay. But from physics, we all know now that perception is mediated by physical elements which exhibit delays. And then the immediate puzzle is how these two facts go together. Fred. Delays are sure, but there are delays, right? Okay. So the way people try to solve this puzzle a long time, since the car time, either falsifying the second assumption or the first one. So either they say, okay, perception is not mediated by physical components, but by something else, like the car. Or nowadays we say, well, perception is not does not really occur in real time, let's say delays are short. We think it occurs in real time. We have an illusion that it happens in real time, but it's not really real time. Okay, we'll get to the perceived time. Okay, but is it real time? Is it real time? Is it a real time with no delays? Do we live in the past? I mean, this is the point of Libet, right? We say we live half a second after reality. Constantly. We don't feel like that, right? No, exactly. But we do feel that we react in time in all events. We don't feel in any case that we react past time. Okay? We feel that we live in the world, right? What? Yes. No, but the question is, when you see dropping, do you feel that you see it in the past? You know that there is a delay for the action. For your action, there is a delay. Right. But for the perception, you think, you feel. We feel that we perceive it in time. So we try to take a different approach, which is not to try to falsify either number two or number one, but try to see whether there is a solution that satisfies both. And we think, and I invite you for another debate, we think that there is one physical system that satisfies both, and this system is closed loop in steady state. What do I mean by that? If the perceiver, whatever the perceiver is, if the perceiver and the object are part of a closed loop, meaning that the perceiver acts on the object and the object acts on the perceiver, and the loop is in a steady state, meaning that its behavior is stable, then P and O have no lag between them. Meaning you cannot say if P is leading or lagging O, or if O is leading or lagging P. Okay, they're equal in terms of lagging each other. Yes. Yes, okay, we agree on that. Okay. You're right. The timing is an issue, but you have a system in which they live in the same time. Okay. Now, what is time? So we say there's no start and no end in such loops. No component is preceding or leading the other. But indeed, there are two time variables. And now the good metaphor that I found for this is a kind of a spiral. So if you think about process in the loop going in the spiral, then you have two time variables. One is the physical time running along the wire of the spiral, and the second is the perceptual time. This is what you're referring to, which runs vertically here. And the loop components are probably blind to the physical time, but they are sensitive to the perceptual time. For example, the loop can count how many times the process runs through the external object or any object in the loop. So indeed, you need to have two different time variables. What? Watching TV? Why? Because of the raster or? Okay, a non-closed loop perception would be something like this. I have this, and I show you this, and I tell you, okay, what did you perceive? This is an open loop perception. You didn't have any chance to move, you know, to stabilize your loops on this thing. And the closed loop perception will be this. Focus on this, then we try to perceive it. This would be the difference. So, open loop would be, you know, if you don't allow the loop enough time to close, basically, on the object. Okay, now why talking about loops? Okay, we have the brain, we have the world, we have the sensory organs interfacing between the brain and the world. Why talking about loops at all? The reason is he's sitting there, David, who 10 years ago showed us actually that the known fact, but he put it nicely, very nicely forward, that sensory systems are actually composed of loops. Basically, a sensory organ and all our sensory organs sits in closed loops, closed sensory and motor loops, in which the motor system moves, let's say the eye, moves the whisker, moves the hand. The movement, like we heard from Yoram previously, the movement actually activates the receptors, whether it's photoreceptors or mechanoreceptors, and this activity flows back through all these loops and affect again the motor components. So sensory organs are parts of the loop. Can the world or objects in the world be also parts of these loops? And the answer is yes, they can. And the way they do it is the following. So we have, let's say, the whisker of the red. There's a motor command that moves the whisker. The whisker moves, touches the object. The contact with the object activates sensory receptors here that are otherwise will not be activated. And this closes the loop. So the object becomes part of the loop because without the object, there was no activity. It's the same with the eye, as we heard before. There's a motor activity there. Rotates the eye. I mean, I couldn't rotate it here. And rotates the eye. The rotation cause some photoreceptors in the retina to be activated, and they send the signals back and close the loop. So basically, an object can become part of the loop just because you have special receptors that are specialized in sensing the features of the object, the color, the location, whatever you want. Truly what? Yes. Okay, that's a good point. So when we met the loops, let's say in the vibrational system, okay, these loops, then we count them, we map them in the order of number of synapses which close the loop. And in this system, the smallest number is of three synapses. This is the brainstem loop, one synapse, second synapse, and the third is on the muscle. And you can count on these loops something like at least up to 8 synapses, and this, the last one, goes through the cortex and through different neurons. And now I agree with you that not everything is known, and maybe in the cortical areas you'll have this additional synapse between, so the feedback comes to one neuron and then there's another neuron that sends the output, etc. But it's not more than 8-10 synapses all the way, and you can order them by this, and you have all spectrum of loops connecting there. Okay, so by this we say that, so we have a definition of perception, which says perception equals inclusion in the brain loop. So by this you say I'll perceive, the rat will perceive the location of the object once the location is included in the loop. We'll talk in a minute what does it mean, but this is a working assumption, a working definition. Okay, so a force field is, of course, is not a real percept, right? It's an illusion. So, so what we say, there's another part of the brain, faculty of the brain that is not included in this discussion, and this is the reporting part. So, you tell me that you saw force fields, okay? There is a part in the brain that can report something, and it interprets whatever happens in the brain and whatever areas we don't know exactly, interprets it something that is communicative. And when you have some activity and I ask you what you say something. You say phosphines because this is the most closest reflection that you have. Interpretation, exactly. Okay. Well, first, we don't know about what they perceive or not, and I'll show you later in the talk where it drives us to know when they perceive or not. Except for human, we cannot really know if they perceive or not. So they do perceive. The question is, what do they perceive? And I would say you take a guinea pig, it doesn't whisk, and you put a ball there, and it stays there and doesn't whisk. It will not perceive the ball in the darkness unless you move something. So the answer will be yes, he doesn't perceive. If you push it with the ball, then it will have this open loop perception, which is totally different than the closed loop perception. Right. So right. So you refer. This is a very good point. Yes, you refer to the. To the efferent copies loops. So I plotted these kind of loops. So you have a sensory organ, and I plotted all these kind of loops. Now you can plot the complementary picture, which is starting somewhere on top. You'll have this kind of loops, which are the efferent copy loops. Right, and the lowest one of them is the one that actually moves the sensory organ, but the earlier ones are those that doesn't have to move the sensory organ in order to get the system to do something, and it will do something. And sometimes you can, I tell you, don't move your eyes, and put your attention there, etc. All this is indeed implemented by these higher loops without involving the sensory organ, but this is the unnatural case. In a natural case, you'll have the movement of the sensory organ, but you'll also have the predicted movement or the preparation of the movement going to the sensory processes to do some processing, and this is indeed, it's there. It doesn't interfere with what I said so far. So perception, the way I define perception is the words are difficult here, but the knowledge about the external object. Sensation would be, in this sense, the activation of the receptor, but I think different people use different interpretation of these words. But let's say, for this context, we'll say sensation is just the activation of sensory afferents in any way. And perception is the knowledge of the brain about a feature that it perceives, the color or the location of the object. So in a way, I mean, this definition says what is perception. And as I said before, this is why I put the first slide, to say we don't have a priori definition of what is perception. If we had, life would be easier, because we'd say, okay, look, this is the definition, and let's see what fits. We don't have. So we have to go circular and say, let's assume that perception is this, and now let's see if everything is consistent with what we assume. So basically, this is the suggestion is that this will be a definition of perception. So once it's included in any brain loop, then it's perception. And it means like the way we behave in the world is like we grab things around, metaphorically. So we grab, so I see you, you're mine now. I perceived you for a while, and then it's temporarily. And then I leave it, and then I perceive something else. So I take something with me, my brain takes something with him, goes for a while until it leaves it out. Again, it's again a difficult distinction of words. And then these words overlap, as I understand it. I would say cognition. Yeah. Yeah.
If you look at that, we could spend all morning talking about that. I mean, the way you drew it is sort of a classic engineering feedback loop. I mean, there's no memory except for parameters that you've frozen in place. But there's no, you're not comparing this with some sort of internal model of some memory you may have.
So from here you can go on. You can go on and induce memory and comparison, because the way of how do you say that this is a cup and not a ball has to do with memory, of course.
Yeah.
But this is higher than the discussion level that I put here. And there goes cognition. It's in a higher level. I'll put there's a vague border between perception and cognition, and I talk about the lower end of this spectrum of knowledge of the brain about the external world, which I call perception. So this would be a working definition. And to test whether the consequences of this assumption are valid, we have to see what are the predictions of this, what are the consequences of this definition. So one is to say that perception is a convergence process that stabilizes only at steady states. Because if you say that we want to keep the real-time perception, it has to be at a steady state condition. And if I just show you the pen, I have to wait until this is until the loop that perceives this object stabilizes. This is one consequence. The second is that stable perception requires the continuous presence of the object during convergence. If you lose the object, then you lose perception. And the third is that perception is blind to the physical time that is smaller than the loop cycle time. And so far, there are experimental evidence for each one of these. For the first one, I'll show you data from the rat whisker system. For the second one, we all know the backward masking phenomena. If you remove the object, or if you put something, you can remove the object from the retina if you put something else instead of it. And this is the phenomenon known as backward masking. If you do it, you don't perceive the first one. So there is experimental evidence for the second one. And the third one are indeed experiments that had been done for years about temporal order judgment. So if I give you two stimulations in any modality, visual, some other sensory, and I ask you, let's say the two fingers, I ask you which one was the first, you cannot do it better than something like these times. And these times are typical for motor sensory loops. Of course, you know, we have all the spectrum. It's hard to say where, but the time fits roughly. So times around 30 milliseconds are typical time for sensory motor loops. Yes. No, so I'll show you data. So about the convergence, I'll show you data and then tell you what we think from the data. So the data we collect are from the rats, and I don't have to, maybe I do. I mean, the main reason that we go for the rats, I think people that work on the Whisker system will agree that the best reason is traceability. I'm not sure, is this the way to say it in English, or trackability? What's the best traceability? So we can trace, we can trace very accurately the behavior of whiskers. Okay, these are tracking of single whiskers when the rat is whisking in air. We can track the exact moments and curvature and phenomena happening in while the whiskers contact external objects. We can track accurately the behavior of these animals. Yes, they were. They were moving. This is kind of an artifact. The you mean this movement or there? Yeah, this is the fitting point. It's just a kind of so there's a spline fitting here, which we point. So the middle point moves, but the actual is just a methodological thing. And we can track. Sorry, behavioral performance of these animals. For example, for localization, they can reach, and this is the work of Per Knudsen, who David mentioned before, they can reach hyperacuity, similar as with vision, with vernier, they can reach hyperacuity, which is, by definition, the threshold is much smaller than the granularity of the receptor. So the inter whisker space is something like this on the average from here to here, and the thresholds for telling which pole is more anterior and posterior, if you use a bilateral discrimination task, are much smaller than this space. So we can track the behavioral performance. We can track the yes. Oh, sorry. Okay. So this is a picture of a rat. This is whisker C2. And these are the collections. These are the collection of all the whiskers C3 that we had in our rats, just in stationary image. And these are the collections of C1. So this gives you the average distance between C2 and C3. Now, if you put the pole here, or here, or here, or here, these rats can still tell us the location. So they can tell us the location in a resolution which is much better than the distance between two whiskers. Sorry. Okay, and we can track the neural circuits. Peter can do it better probably. But the system is well so far is well tracked with some holes that we still don't know, but. The potential of this system to be fully tracked is very high because it's not too big. It's not too big like the visual system, and much of the connectivity is already known. So the circuits can be tracked. And the functioning of the, let's say for this specific task of object localization, okay, what we were able to track is also the encoding a scheme of object location and some aspects of the encoding scheme. And let me just review them briefly. If you open the loop for the measurement and you record from the very first cells in the system, which are the dendrites are actually the receptors in the follicle, and this is the famous follicle. Let's skip all this. Then what you see is that, and you test the system in two conditions, in free air, in I think most of you know it, so I'll go for it very, very fast. And just, you don't know? So some of you know it, okay. So you artificially make the whisker move by stimulating the fascial nerve, yeah? And you couldn't tell the difference if I show you the movie between the behaving and the anesthetized one. So the mechanics, the reason we do it is to keep the mechanics at the follicle as in the natural case, because it turns out to be important. Why is it important? Because the selectivity in this active condition, when we keep the mechanics here active, is totally different than the selectivity in the case that if this is the whisker, you move it with passive stimulation from the outside. And the selectivity in the passive case is the known textbook selectivities between slowly adapting and rapidly adapting, stimulus direction and stimulus intensity. However, in the active mode, you get totally different kinds of selectivity. You get a selectivity between self-motion whisking. So you have cells that are sensitive to the self-motion of the whiskers. If the whiskers move in air, these cells fire. They are not sensitive to contact, if the contact is not blocking the movement, if it's far enough. On the other hand, you have cells that are not sensitive at all, do not fire at all for whisking in air, and they will fire only when the whisker touches objects. And this kind of selectivities cannot be found if you just move the whisker from the outside, because by this movement, you activate all these neurons together in a non-selective way. So this is the reason that we use this active mode, still in anesthetized animal. So about one quarter are the whisking cells, and about one quarter are the more than one quarter, like one quarter, 25% are whisking cells. About 40% are touch cells, and they have different. Some of them are report on the contact on cells. Some of them report on the detach, like off cells. And the rest report on the continuous pressure. These are three types of the touch cells. And then you have something like 30% of the whisking touch cells and some non-responding cells also in the repertoire. This is intrageminal ganglion, the very first order fibers. Yes. Now, so these are the types. And now we ask, how do they code the location of the object? Let's say there is an object here, some place. And you can describe it in three Cartesian coordinates. What we found is that you have actually what we call an orthogonal coding scheme for this location. So every axis in this Cartesian map is encoded by a different variable. The vertical aspect, which goes this way, is encoded by label line code, or if you wish, by space. So the identity of the whisker that contact the object tells you what is the height of the object. The horizontal one, along the dimension of movement of the whiskers, is coded by time. The longer the time it takes for the contact, the more anterior is the object. No. Right. That's in principle, yes. So the details are, we know better from David's work and from other science that there are some specific parameters of time that are encoded here, but this is a separate issue. This is just to say that you have three different variables in general to encode the tree. The third one is the rate. The intensity of firing will go down as the contact is made further and further from the face. So these are three orthogonal variables. Schematically, you might say that if you have these three coordinates, by the fact of that the cell fires at all, it encodes already the vertical one. By the time delay from whisking onset to response response. It encodes a horizontal one, and by the total number of spikes, it encodes the radial dimension. So basically, you can have one fiber conveying all this information and three decoders reading the same information, but every one reads a different aspect of the information.
But again, in fairness, to give you a hard time, you're on a polyfill, so it's not a lot of work to get this around. So you look at lateral forces versus,
actual forces, yeah.
No,
this goes. So how it is translated in the how it is encoded in the follicle is a different question. So what David says is that if the contact is here, and this is the normal force, and you divide it to two axes, or it's here, you'll have a different mapping of the two, the axial force and the tangential force in the follicle. This is one mapping we have. Another mapping is that the radial distance actually maps to the torque at the base, basically here, of the on the follicle. And then there's the question of the whisker goes all the way. The question is which one of these receptors are actually transduce these variables to neural activity. What we measure is what comes out from the nerve and goes inside. We look at the neurons here, and we ask what in their firing, what of their firing variables is correlated with the distance, and this comes out to be the firing rate. So the firing rate goes down as R, if this is R, R increases. This is the finding. But this is still an open question, how it is translated here. That's right? Yes, but if you could use velocity also, but I think the best variable, this is the work of Mitra, and actually it was done even before, this is the theory of elastic beam. The theory of elastic beam says that the curvature here is correlated with the torque at the base, and the curvature is also correlated with the distance of the radial distance of the object. And then you get this correlation. The second correlation is what you mentioned here, is by the mapping, the ratio between these two axes. But this was not worked out theoretically yet to show what is the actual mapping. But I agree, the information is there, should be there also. But how it is done, it is an open question. I mean, the whole follicle is and there's a very... it keeps a lot of wisdom in it, I would say, and it's waiting for the right work to be done in order to see how the interaction with the external world is actually transduced in the follicle to neural signal. Yes, the time window, typical one, time window will be per neuron one. Small. You need, and there are something like 200 neurons per follicle. So the touch neurons will be this 40%. So you'll have, let's say 80 neurons.
So neurons
you might say yes. You could sum the neurons across the spike across the population, and use this number. Okay, so what we did again, you're right. So this is when talking about the actual receptors here. What we did is we measured the spike activity, and then we measured the latency and measured the spike rate. And there is, you're right that there is a little bit latency, correlation between the latency and the radial distance. There is some. But if you just compare, I didn't bring the data here. If you compare the information you have in the latency to the information you have in the firing rate, it's much, you have much more in the firing rate. And it's the reverse in the horizontal one. The horizontal, you have most of the information in the latency. Okay, so note also that, you know, just talking about coding in general, usually we assume that there is the same code. Let's say we talk about whether the neural code is rate code or temporal code, and the hidden assumption behind it is that we have one code, and different neurons express it, and then the way to tell what was the stimulus outside there is to look at the neurons that actually increase the firing rate. Let's say the firing rate is the code, then we look at which is the neuron that expressed the firing rate. This is a different scheme which says you can convey different codes with the same neurons, and it's more efficient, as you can see here, than assuming only one code per feature. And all by firing rate. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be so. I mean, it would be one, but nobody talks about it. Basically, I mean, the Vernier one is a latency code or delay code that is propagating all the way to V1, but people do not talk about it. But by this scheme, you could. If you would talk about it, you would have the same neuron conveying more than a single bit of information. Okay, the second thing we know. But the next thing we know about it is how these signals are conveyed in the system. So these are the loops, and we already know that what I told you, the whisking signal, the signal that reports the proprioceptive-like one, that reports the self-motion, goes separately than the touch signal all the way to the thalamus. This is data from anesthetized animal. It's still waiting for its approval in awake animal, but in the anesthetized case, it comes very clear. It goes through the POM, the proprioceptive whisking signal, and the touch signal goes through VPMVL, one of the stations of VPMVL, and they start to merge only in the cortex, in both S1 and S2. All the thalamocortical network, of course, including all the feedback connections, has these signals starting to merge. And of course, if you want to, now if you talk about decoding, and you want to, you know, to know where is the object in space, you need to know where is the whisker at every given time, and when touch occurred. If you combine these two pieces of information, then you'll know where is the object. If you look at only the contact, regardless of the position of the whisker, you'll not know where is the object in space, right? You have to combine the two. So the combining the two happens only in the thalamocortical network. And let me make this short, because I want to show you another thing. Don't worry about it. okay, so we ask what's going on in the thalamocortical network in the anesthetized animal when we move the whiskers in the way we want. And we look only at the horizontal localization. I showed you three coordinates. We focus now only on the horizontal one. So time is important, and these two signals are important. They are the basis for decoding. If you look, we recorded from 8 different stations in the thalamocortical network, the 3 thalamic nuclei and 2 laminar divisions in S2 and 3 laminar divisions in S1. The divisions are based on anatomical data from anatomical projections, where the majority goes to. And if you just look at, let's say, how the population activity looks in each of these stations as a function of time, when whisking occurs at 5 hertz, so every 200 milliseconds, we have one cycle. The whisker goes forward and backward, forward and backward, forward and backward. There are 10 cycles like this in 2 seconds. Okay, 10 cycles of whisking. And you see that you see peaks of activity locked to the whisking. What I would like you to note, I'll show you this picture again now, but just moving from the left. try to see when you can predict the next response. Let's say focus on the top one, on the second one, and see when you can when you predict the next response. So I hope somewhere here you could say that okay, I already know what's coming because it's similar to what was before. And before that line, the responses are fluctuating more. Look at the top row, for example, and then it stabilizes, and then the response look more similar from cycle to cycle. So we call this period the steady state because behavior is predicted, and this is the transient state, the first four cycles. It's loosely defined here. So I use your perception now to say, okay, I can predict it. But right now it was in terms of the population code, but I'll show you other aspects also. It was just population response. Sorry? So what we did, but we didn't analyze it fully, what we did is FM modulation, frequency modulation. So it was not random, but like 40% in depth, like between 3, this was 5 hertz, so we modulated between 3 hertz and 8 hertz at about 1 hertz or something like this. Roughly it's similar, but we didn't analyze it fully like this one. So you do have the peaks, etc., but whether they stabilize in a longer period, I agree. Another extra one. To this frequency. It's not a bizarre. I mean, this is the kind of a natural whisking rate. For this system, it's a familiar. This is familiar rate, let's say. But it's very periodic. You can get what? You can get it periodic, especially. No. I agree with you. When so at the end point, and also the last slide I'll show is that actually in behavior you'll have the system will manipulate also the frequency and amplitude, etc. We froze it. We opened the loop here. I mean, the question is right. Okay, we opened the loop in order to systematically test what we see. But eventually we'll have to try to close it and let all these things be viable. And the question is valid, I agree. But it's not far from what we see. I mean, you can find epochs of close to. No, it wasn't compared. I mean, it was a bad paper because it was not really compared. I mean, if you want, the question is how do you compare it? So you have, if you would mimic, try to mimic the kinematics of the movement. Usually what people do when they move the, this chokes, I cannot breathe. Okay. Right. I mean, you feel it so rapidly. So usually when people use the passive ones, the kinematic is much, much faster than the kinematic of the natural movement. So the actual comparison was never done. If you would do, you should keep all other parameters the same. So you should keep the kinematic the same, just move it passively versus actively. And then ask a question, this experiment was not done. When people do the very fast kinematics with piezo stimulations and compare it to the active kinematics, then you can see differences in. So if you just take a neuron that responds in both conditions, as I showed, the selectivity will be different. You'll have different neurons. If you move it passively, you'll activate neurons that if you move the whisker actively and let them touch, they will not fire. Okay, so the selectivity is different. But if the neuron fires in the same cases, then there will be differences in the kinematics of the response, like the sharpness of the first peak of the response, etc. This kind of.
So if you look at your videos of whisking, how much trial variability is there?
How much what?
Trial variability is there. Same whisker making contact with the same marker.
I'll show you. There is a variability and quite a bit variability. Yeah, I'll show you in the behaving case. Yeah.
Is it sure that all of the receptors are identical?
No, they are not identical. Actually, if you look at the figure of Barra and the rice that I showed, the colorful figure of the follicle. So every receptor, of course, by definition, is situated in a different location. It feels a different profile of pressures. And it has a different, some of them are oriented like this, some of them like this, different types. There are at least five types, maybe more, and different location, different orientation. But they are not identical. Okay, so I show you the summary of the results of 201 neurons that were recorded in this network. Basically, we tested two frequencies, 5 Hz and 8 Hz, and three object positions, 1, 2, 3, P1, P2, P3, or 3L. These were the four conditions. And basically what we found that out of the 201, 91 coded the position of the object in at least one of the following codes. And the codes we didn't apply so far an objective way to measure the codes. We might do it with Adrian in the future. What we did is looked at the PSTHs, see by eye if they seem to convey information about the position. For example, if we see something like this and we say this is position one, position two, position three, we call it a coding cell. So there's an information in the timing of the response. Then we quantify and test for statistical difference, etc. But the way we define these four types is by looking at the PSTH and say, look, this might be a code and that might be a code. So in all these stations, they are distributed in all the stations. I'll show you the distribution. But in all the stations, we found the four codes. One is the simple temporal code that we saw also in the ganglion cells, just the input code. Second was a surprising code, we call it a rate code. It's a code in which the temporal information disappeared. And what you have is this cell, for example, it fires less for position one, more for position two, and more for position three, but all synchronized in time. It's a puzzling question of how this code could be generated. So I'll show you the distribution in a minute. We have different distributions for this. This is a windowed labeled line code. So labeled line would be a neuron that fires for only one position. It was true for these neurons, but only if you look at the given time window between 20 to 60. If you forget about the initial peak. And we had a real labeled line code in which these neurons fired only for one position. But know that the firing rate of this labeled line code was significantly lower than the rest. Okay, we think it means something about the mechanism that produced them. The distribution in the steady state, this is a distribution of the median strength of the code. Okay, we have measurement of the strength of the code, like the R squared, the correlation coefficient between the contact angle and the time of response, or between the contact angle and the number of spikes in the response for these two, and the selectivity index for the labeled line ones. So this is what I said, that I think we discussed it yesterday with David and Adrian, and I think we should go for a more objective way of describing them. We might also, look at this code. We have the distributions of this code, and we can look at the distributions and see. Of course, it's not a sharp. We can apply significance value. So we know, let's say, I don't remember, there are 30 neurons or 40 neurons who show significance temporal coding. So they cross the 1% level. But there are some other neurons that are 2% and 5%, that I don't know where to put the border. So of course there is a continuum with some distribution. I don't know how to say more than this. And I'm sure also that the information is better. So you have the temporal information also in some neurons that we don't call significant because we don't have enough samples to show that this is statistically significant, but it doesn't mean that they don't carry the information. I don't know how to answer this better. This. Yes. Yeah, it can, in principle. Not many of them, but it can. I'll show the numbers, then you see it sums to more than 91. So the important thing here is to show that these window line labeled line codes are mostly in the S2 stations, and the labeled line code is mostly in S1 layer 2, 3 on top. And we think, and I'll show you something, it goes together with another observation. Sorry. And these codes develop from the transient state to the steady state, mostly for the labeled line codes. At least the distribution develops, and I'll show you more about the actual development of this code. So, okay, the next thing we looked at is the stability of this coding, which means how much. So, if you analyzed the strength of the code. Of the representation in every cycle, and we ask how much it is similar to the previous cycle, then you get the stabilization profiles, which take something like 4 or 5 cycles, in which the labeled line ones stabilize first, the two labeled line ones, and the temporal and the rate code stabilize later and also show less of dynamics. Similarity between one cycle to the other, just to ask how much they are similar. So how much they're getting closer to the steady state. Yeah, I could ask the similarity to the steady state. Yeah, we could do that. That's a good idea. Why they go up? I don't know. We ask ourselves that maybe it's too long. See, at the end, what we think that in the behaving case, this is artificial case. In the behaving case, the animal will never stay longer than this period. It gets what it needs. It never stay and do more and more and more. So maybe the system is not optimized and then it get tired or something. I don't know. We ask ourselves the same question. Sorry? Yes, right now it's number of touches, yes. Yeah. Also in the behaving animal, every cycle is a single touch. Which one there? Yes, the labeled line. But it's non-linear, right? The labeled line is non-linear relationship. Okay, now, so if you ask how many, so it takes about 4 or 5 cycles for the system to stabilize, for the cost to stabilize, and if you ask how many cycles the animal actually need, this is from Per's experiment again, from this experiment, then if you count with me here the contacts, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it goes back. And this turns out to be, this is a typical example, this is the distribution of the number of contacts it needs. And it stays around 4, these are the gray lines, no matter what is the difficulty of the task. If it's a very close offset or long offset, it always 4. Yes.
So, this is 4 colors. Now, representation in a single file, and then your file of first stabilization, it sort of seems to imply that there is no meaningful color.
There's no meaningful what? Why should you? So in the behavioral case, you have a single trial. It takes about 4 cycles. The animal perceives the location of the poles, goes back, and reports on it. The next trial is already a different position. You should not integrate across trials.
One, two, three values per sensor to go up.
We should do it, yeah. We should do it. I tell you something. It's not easy to do, by the way, to move the poles without animal feeling. This is a very rapid system, as you know, and you have to have a very rapid motion which induces something that the animal will feel. So it's not like disappearing. Either you induce a lot of noise or you do some. But I agree, this is a nice experiment. We have clear prediction for this. Yeah. Yes. I'll address it in the next set of experiments that I'll show you. I'll address this issue. Okay. So what we okay. The last observation for this system I'll show you is the observation of two waves that's running here. One is the usual bottom-up wave, which goes from thalamus to the cortical levels, and in this case, I plot there the distribution of the latencies in each station. It turns out that S1 layer 2, 3 comes out the last. This is this one. So the neurons there respond usually the last ones in this scheme, and note that S1 and S2 are parallel. S2 probably in this system does not mean any hierarchy. So at least up to the cat level, in the primate level, it's debated whether S2 is a higher hierarchy than S1. But in the rodent level, I think it is agreed upon, both anatomically and functionally, that these two are parallel. And it's not clear who is higher than whom. It might even be that S2 is kind of lower in functional hierarchy than S1. Anyway, the other thing which was new was a slow wave that we observed. So if you just filter all the responses with a low cutoff frequency, then you see that you might see it before in the general slide that I showed. You see that the activity peaks roughly after this is one, first cycle, second, etc. After the second cycle, and then goes back. And there are different delays for different stations of when they peak, when the slow activity peaks. And the general flow is top down. So you have S1 layer 2, 3 is almost the first here. And then the other cortical layers, and then the thalamic nuclei are coming last. So the wave goes back from S1 down to the thalamus, except of POM, which shows the smallest variation. This is the dashed brown one, smallest variation, but still it is the first to peak the POM. So we think, from many other observations, it seems that POM is more like proprioceptive motor, belongs to the proprioceptive motor control systems. And because it comes out first here, it might be that this means that actually the waves is originated in the motor-related areas. And to remind you, it's all anesthetized animal triggered by external stimuli. So it's all kind of hardwired. There's no top-down design of whisking, etc. It's all triggered by the stimuli, but still evoke this wave. Yes. To which system? So according to Romo, there is a hierarchy between S1 and S2, and there is a transformation from temporally coded to rate coded in S2. In his hands, there is a hierarchy. Could be. So I would say that they are parallel. So I would say that at least also in the monkeys, the hypothesis that there are two parallel streams, one is processed by S2 and one by S1, should be checked. According to almost straightforward interpretation, he thinks about the hierarchy that goes from S1 to S2. It's not what? You could go, let's say, phase lock loops or something like this, could translate. You have some translators that could translate. You could think of mechanisms to do it, but I think it should be checked. In the primate, the debate is still open. In the rodent, I think there is an agreement, at least for the parallelism. And, yeah. Yes. It's the same four cycles. The time scale is the same four cycles. So we think this is actually what shapes this four, so it sets the dynamics of all this convergence. Off? One second, synaptic regression? Might be, okay. Might be the same time scale. Might be some of the underlying mechanisms. Yeah, definitely. But it's not only depression, know that there's some excitation there. I mean, it's not a depression process. It goes excitation and depression. Okay, so we think, so these codes, so we have this network with this wave dynamics, we have these codes spread around with some hotspots. What we think is that there are some, okay, we can explain some transformation between codes, like a threshold mechanism that takes let me start over. Okay, we have this, I jumped one stage. Okay, we have this code spread around, and it all was in an anesthetized case. Okay, so we refer to it as a hardwired circuit that you can trigger even in an anesthetized case. In the behaving case, this should be part of the entire motor sensory system that actually moves the whisker, change the frequency, change everything, but still you have this machinery working there. Why we think is the case, we have two reasons to think so. One is a matching with David results. So David has a very elegant study in the awake animal in S1 to show actually, that shows actually the coincidence detection of this whisking information and touch information happening mostly in layer 4 of a little bit layer 5 of S1. If we translate his findings to the language that I described to you here, then the coding should be a combined, what we call combined temporal and rate code, which means you have the temporal code. This is the different times of contact. So the red, green, and blue, but they are strongly modulated. So in one case you have the green one strongest, and the other case you have the red one strongest. So you have a tuning curve for angle, which is in David's findings, is done by the modulation of the tuning to the position of the whiskers with some specific inhibitory mechanisms that generates it. So the coincidence of finding that the same code in our hands also happens in layer 4, layer 5A, and in David's behaving animals, these are the results, is the same place we take as one indication that this might be the same circuit functioning in the awake animal. And the other one is this convergence in four cycles that we see both the hardwired circuit and the behaving animal both converge in about four cycles to a solution, let's call it, of object. Yes.
So in S1, layer 5A is one of the different.
Is one of the?
So the arrows in call, I just wanted to be sure about the attitude. Layer 5A is one of the different.
Yes, it's a Talamo recipients of mostly of the POM.
And directly projections.
Yes, yes. And also back projections, but I only exploded this one. Cerebellar input. So if the cerebellum, let's say, maybe modulates this slow wave, then yes, who knows? Could be. Why, do you have a reason to, a reason to think that it's cerebellum? Is there some dynamics of? It could be maybe in the sense that the cerebellum is a kind of a forward model, and then it kind of set the general time scale for the performance. Could be. Yeah. Okay, so how do you feel about time? What's the? Okay, this is a nice piece of evidence from a human model of the rat that we took. And if you feel tired, you know, feel free to do other things. But we think it's very nice. And this goes together with the question of the convergence process. So from whatever I told you, yeah. Multi what? Multi?
Texas scheme where objects are in space. Instead of, you took a sort of Cartesian coordinate system, sort of a spherical coordinate system, but you want to comment on how the rat actually takes this information and do identification of objects?
No, what we think about identification, I talked about these two pathways, the whisking and the touch, and there was a third one, which I didn't say a word about it. This is the most sophisticated channel of all, probably the last word of evolution in this system. This is the lemniscal pathway. It's much more detailed in space, much more accurate in time, and we think this is the system that conveys object identification, which is a much harder task than localization. So we think the principles might be similar to what we found here, but we focus on the simpler task, which is localization. And the older, evolutionary speaking, the older systems, the paralemniscal and the extralemniscal. The lemniscal one is far more complicated story. And what we hope is to learn the principles from these systems and then to apply them for. OK, what I want to take you through here is a simple question. The question is, so from whatever I said so far, it means that the motor signals coming, driving the sensory organs are part of perception, basically, because they determine how the whisker moves. Without this, you don't have perception. And but the actual contribution of motor signals to perception was never addressed. And the reason, and this is a collaboration with Amos Arieli. Some of you know him. And the students who did the job is Avi Saim. And what we ask is, what are the relative contributions of motor and sensory components to perception? And what underlies perceptual improvement, actually, motor or sensory variables? And note that in order to address this question, you must track all relevant sensory and motor variables that are underlying the task. If you leave some out, then you always can say, oh, maybe it's the other variable that you never track. So in order to do that, what we had to do is to evolve a new sense. Because with the existing senses, with the adult person, that with the sense that he lived with all his life, things are complicated. You never know what he uses in order to solve the task. What we did, the evolution process we did in Rehovot, is to take the rat as an example and to evolve this Homo Rehovotus whiskerus. So these hands grow whiskers, you see. And the whiskers comes with two kinds of sensors. Okay, one is a position sensor, and one is a force sensor. So we get, this is a sensor that tells us report the motor component of the of perception. And this one tracks the sensory component of perception. So you have one position sense. What? No, there is a one whisker. So the whisker sits here. OK, you do it this. This is extremely attached like this. And we only measure the force between the whisker base and the finger. It cannot move laterally. No, it is attached firmly.
Completely attached.
Like this. It doesn't move this way. You have a curvature. But this is minimized here because we attach it firmly. And what you have is the torque here, actually.
The skin is elastic, so
okay, Okay, it's not ideal, but I mean, it's negligible, I think. The shear force are negligible. It doesn't really move across the skin. And the light is very touch. If you would force it, you know, very, so I'll show you. The light is very touch. It's not. So, this is Per Knudsen, by the way. So it, and we took the task of Per. So the task is the task of the rats. But the whisking human looks like this. It's much more primitive way. It's so slow. I mean, this animal is so slow. So the way it goes is this. Is we with the measurement. So if this is, come on. this is the time scale, and then we measure position and force for the left hand and the right hand, and this is how it looks in time. Okay, if you analyze this, then I have to stretch the video in order to show you that basically we have a conversion from space to time in the following way. So the contact with the right pole here is translated to time by the force, the transition of the force. I mean, we measure it by the force, but also the finger measure it by the mechanoreceptors. So this gives you the time of contact of the right pole, and the other one gives you the contact time of the left pole. So what you have is a translation of delta x, which is the actual perceived quantity, to delta t. Here we have, because we had two contacts, we have two delta t's. One is larger than the other, while one is larger than the other, because in this case, the velocity is higher than the velocity there, you can see by the slope. And there is some motor error. You see that the red and the green ones are not coordinated. There is error between them, which decreases delta t. We know, and this is the advantage of using this animal. We can ask this animal what it does, and we know that the perceptual cue was delta t. We know it because of introspection, but also because of other, like confusion matrices, etc. We know that they did solve the task by delta t, and if they solve the task by delta t, then there's a very simple equation that gives you all the variables in the task. Delta t equals delta x, which is the actual offset, minus delta h, which is the discoordination of the hands, if they are off one the other, divided by the velocity. This is delta t. And so delta x divided by v is the code, the actual code, and the error is delta h, is the discoordination between the hands divided by v. Because? Yes. So delta h divided by v. No, if you so the question we ask them is binary, whether right hand is, if you would ask them to estimate exactly your right, we ask them whether this is more anterior or this one, and then you don't have error by this, but the resolution depends on it. They could be. So this is one of the questions that we ask, what they were doing here. So if you focus on the coding one, then what we have here, let's say for the left hand, so we have the motor sensory loop. The motor variable is V. The V that exerted by the motor loop determines the transformation between X and T, okay, the slope of this transformation, and T is the variable that comes back to the system. The same for the right hand. And the actual thing that the brain does is take some representation of both, we don't know exactly what, compares them, and gives a decision. So as we said, we ask right or left. It has to take the representation of the two T's, compare them, and say right or left. Okay? There should be a similar scheme controlling delta H, but this is a bilateral scheme now. Let's leave it aside just for this sake of the description. So we tested various effects of various variables. One of them was the number of whiskers. If they use two whiskers or one whisker, it had no effect on perception. This is similar in the rats. If you remove the whiskers, it doesn't have an effect. But experience had a lot of effect. So between the first session And the second session, the threshold went down from 7 centimeters to about 3 centimeters, a very dramatic effect of experience. So what we asked is basically what underlies this improvement. Are these the motor variables or the sensory variables? So for this, we compare the psychometric curve. And we do the psychometric curve both for the task variable, which is delta x, actually. This is the blue one. And delta t, which is the red one. And we normalize both to the maximal values. And you can immediately see that in the first session, because of what I tell you, I mean, this is consistent with this, that they base the decision on delta t, you see that the psychometric curve is much sharper for delta t than for delta x. This is what we asked them, but they actually answered on delta t. Now, in the next day, they improved, meaning that they had delta x better now. Okay, so the sigmoid of delta x is now sharper, meaning that they perceive delta x better, but nothing changed in the way they perceive delta t. The sharpness of the of reading out delta t remains the same. Okay, there is another way you can look at it is by looking at the mutual information between their answer and delta x in session 1 and session 2, and compare it to the mutual information between the answer and delta t. And you can see that in the case of delta t, it's close to the maximal information both in session 1 and session 2, and there is no improvement between the sessions. So the sensory readout did not change. They used the same sensory readout, but somehow they map delta x to delta t better in the second session. And this is shown here. So the mutual information between delta x and delta t, this is in the first session, this is in the second session, and of course it's better, you have more information in delta t on delta x in the second session. This is the solid line. Now if you compare these two lines, then you have both, in order to do, I mean, you can interpret the transition both as a leftward transition or upward transition. So to discriminate between the two, differentiate the two, what we did is we aligned both curves on the threshold value here. This is the threshold of the second, the threshold of the first session. And if you do it, you see that you have both upward improvement of the curve for the same delta x's. And we call this an improvement in accuracy. Okay, so this is, so basically for every delta, given a delta x, you do better, they did better in the second session than in the first session. And this is simply because of the error component, the delta h. If they take delta h down, then the error goes down, delta t represents better delta x, and you get this upward improvement. And to show that this is indeed the case, when you correlate the error term, delta h divided by velocity, with percent correct, you get perfect correlation across the two sessions. So this is data from the two sessions. The other improvement is the shift to the left. Shift to the left is increased in resolution, basically. You are sensitive now to smaller offsets. And this is caused by reducing V. So if you reduce V in the coding term, then you can map for the same delta T, you can map smaller delta X's. Okay, so delta T does not change. You can read the same delta T. Now you want to be sensitive to smaller offsets, you have to reduce velocity. And then you get it. And indeed, if you correlate, these are the seven subjects of the study, you correlate the improvement in threshold to the improvement in to the reduction in velocity, and you get very strong correlation between the two. Okay, so what we learned from this motor sensory study is first that we were able, by using this whisking in humans model, we were able to measure from all sensory variables, which is one, delta t. We know now, we can ask the subject and we know what is the sensory variable, we measure it. And by doing this, we show that Changes in motor variables alone, without any change in the sensory variable, is enough, sufficient to improve perceptual resolution and accuracy significantly. And this was not, I mean, people showed before that performance depends on the motor pattern, et cetera, but just in general words. But nobody was able to show that quantitatively what happens, and specifically to show that it's enough to change the motor variables without any change in the sensory variables, simply because people could not measure all relevant sensory variables and show that they were not changed. So the conclusion is that perception is affected by changes along the entire motor sensory loop. It's not only the sensory, not only the motor. This case was only the motor, but we don't think that it has to be the general case. And general case is probably effect of the entire loop. Okay, last point, just to... there's only one more point for this, which is the dynamics. And just again to stress the convergence process, which we see also in humans, then I show you that also they show whisking cycles, okay? And they exert more whisking cycles when the task is more difficult. This is offset of -4 versus 13. So when it's more difficult, they do more whisking cycles. In session 2, it's the same picture, but the whole thing shifts. Okay, now this is considered easy and this is considered difficult. And in general, what you have is a very nice exponential dependency of the number of whisks used versus delta t, the difficulty of the task. And because of this, we say this is not the entire scheme. It's not that you do it once and then you decide. Instead of this, you have here some cumulative function, which is logarithmic because of this exponential dependency, which you compare to a threshold. If you say you don't have enough data, then you run another cycle, and change the variables accordingly. You do compare, so you, when you decide that you pass a threshold, you decide that you have enough information, then you indeed use the same psychometric curve for the accumulated data. So you've accumulated data in the internal representations, the delta R, and you compare it to whatever, your criterion circuit. So this is derived from the exponential dependency here. And what happens is that indeed, in this loop, the system does change the variables of exploration systematically. And actually, it was pretty surprising to see that the dependency is exponential again. So it changed the amplitude of the whisking, the duration of every cycle, and the set point, these are the three here, in exponential manner, which probably says something nice about this convergence mechanism. This you can achieve only with human. I mean, with rats you never get such exponential curve. So, interestingly, velocity you see is not one of these, and velocity was not changed within a trial. It was changed, as I showed you, between the sessions. So globally, the system converges to smaller velocities. But it was not a variable that was changed from cycle to cycle. In different cycles, it changed, it stayed the same. Yes. Yes. Exactly. I would say not, because of this result, because we didn't see adaptation of velocity in the trial, within a trial. We did between sessions, not within a trial. So velocity is, first it is controlled here, because once you have the contact, this is very low level, once you have the contact, you reduce velocity, of course, because you stop and you go back. So you have it here, you have it in the session level, which is probably higher loop in this way of presenting it. But in the intermediate level of a single trial, we didn't see a control of velocity. So my prediction would be that if you do it, it will be stuck. You will be confused.
But
you change. If you do it dramatically, then it will lose contact, then it will do something. He will do something, I'm sure. If suddenly you lose contact, he will be confused and do something dramatic. But if you do it small, a little bit, so contact is still there. So my prediction, based on this, but this is a prediction, testable prediction, basically. Again? Yes, yeah, cycle, every cycle is one sample of the location, because you have one contact per.
Vary the time
for the. So this is up to the subject. So the subject chooses what is the period, and if you look there. Yeah. Yeah, this is the period that the subject, so this is the contact time. About that? Yeah, so it's pretty periodic. You see, you know, you can figure out the frequency here, and it's pretty periodic, of course, not perfectly, it's modulated. The duration changes, as I showed you before, the duration, so the frequency changes within the trial. Okay, it becomes shorter and shorter, so the frequency increases as you get closer to the contact. But basically, it's a periodic process. You see, this is one sample, another sample, another sample, another sample. This is a very good example. So, yeah, you get. And there is a lot of variability between subjects. It's not. These are examples. So the general case is this, but there's significant variability. Okay. So. Yeah, we'll finish. Yeah. So we don't know. The answer is that we don't know what's the accuracy of the position representation of in the rat. What we can see in the rat is that it similarly they show a convergence process. So the advantage of the convergence is that whatever your accuracy is, you do not depend on the accuracy. Why? If it was an open loop process, you would say if it was an open loop process. So you say I move once, I touch, and then I have my computer running and compute everything. Then it depends crucially on the resolution of your system. But with a convergent system, you do it repeatedly until you are sure. So you converge on a solution. You reduce velocity, you reduce whatever, until you have some internal criteria that says, okay, I'm confident about it. So you don't really depend, the accuracy of the position maybe will tell you I need more cycles in order to get to the solution, but will not limit your final resolution. This is an advantage of this. Okay, so to summarize, I said perception is, you can take it as an assumption or an attempt to define perception by inclusion in a motor sensory loop. Inclusion means convergence to steady state, as I showed you. So steady state will be some later stage in this process. Convergence via dynamic motor and fixed sensory processes. So at least from this pair of experiments that I showed you, it seems that the sensory variables are not so readily changed. This is much more hardwired circuit. It takes much longer to change. I mean, long plasticity processes, maybe over days, weeks. But the motor ones, from cycle to cycle, you change them. And this is the red. If the system wants to converge on something, the first thing to do is just to adjust the motor variables. And basically, they are equal players. I mean, usually you open Wikipedia on perception, and they say, okay, perception begins when the stimulus hits the retina, something like this. And this is wrong. I mean, perception doesn't begin there. But perception, if anywhere, it begins with the motor movement of the eye or the motor movement of the whisker. And I think that's okay. Open question, just to. So still, we don't know what is perception, of course, but to be more specific, how does it emerge from convergence in closed loop exactly? At what point perception emerges? What determines the accuracy and resolution? I'll show an example, but this is still open. how movements of the sensory organ are controlled exactly, how different loops interact, talking about localization and identification, for example, how different loops evolve and develop, what is the function of each loop, it's not known. What principles are common across senses? So can we take the tactile case to the visual case, for example? And if we understand this, then we can understand maybe sensory substitution for the blind, for example. And again, Peter's question about perception and cognitive function. So when we report something that we perceive, how this interaction works. Okay. So I tell you, there's one confusion in this field of action perception, which people mean different things. So many people refer to the action as action of the skeleton movement. Okay, let's say, so they say, I have to move, I have to act upon something in order to perceive, and they say, okay, I see something and I act with my arms. This is not the type of action of motor sensory loops that I refer to here. All these motor sensory loops are closed within one sensory modality. So if you talk about seeing, it's the motor command of eye movement. It's not arm movement. If you talk about listening in the talk, the example you use, these are the motor afferents to the outer hair cells in the cochlea that tune your input. This will be the active one. And you cannot perceive it if you don't have them. I mean, for audition, it's the less we know, but let's go back to vision. You cannot perceive if you don't move your eye. I mean, this is what we heard before. This is, you simply see a gray world. You cannot perceive if you don't move your head. So this is the strong action perception link, and this you cannot break. If people talk about, you know, I have to move my hand when I see something, this, of course, you can say, okay, I don't have to move when I still see. It's not a problem. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, this is another point of discussion. What's the best method to address everything? But this is just for the general. Sorry, what is that?
The evolutionary tree.
Evolutionary tree, yeah. We have only to think. Eventually, we only see. Theoretician is. And these are the. These are the guys. Okay, thanks. Yes, and actually it was a staircase session in which when they were right, they got a more difficult one next time. When they were wrong, it was less difficult. In the red, for the red? Okay, with the rats, we're now in the middle of the process, try to process the same kind of motor sensory process. The picture that seems to emerge, and it's a limited number of rats, is that the convergent process goes something like this. It starts with the technique, the temporal difference, and ends with putting the two whiskers on the two poles, and then using some kind of what we call motor memory, and then keep it like this when they go back and go to drink from their side. So they kind of converge to the solution and take it with them to drink from the. It's more complex than the human case, and I mean the human model is very beneficial in one thing that you can ask them. You have this internal problem that you can never achieve with the rat. And the second, they're less viable for some reason. I mean, the rats, every rat is a different story. It begins with the thing that we cannot even tell the rat what to do, right? We put him there, we let him experience, and every rat develops its own strategy. With humans, you tell them, this is the task, and then you ask them how you did it. It's very well defined in this term, so the results are clearer. No, I tell you what the thing about the sniffing stuff is that people show that the rats can discriminate between, in extreme cases, using only one sniff. It doesn't mean that when the task is difficult or in normal situation, they don't sniff more. And actually, the evidence shows that they do. Thank you.